I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The cost of health care is a constant concern for small towns in Kansas. A closed hospital means longer drives to get treatment and a host of other problems, but there may be some hope. Today, learn about a model that could help communities stay healthy. Independence, Kansas managed to put the pieces back together after its hospital doors shuttered. Then, being on the receiving end of racism is a never-ending fear for people of color, one that can be hard for others to understand. To help tell that story, we'll hear about an opera about the daily worries of driving while black. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Since 2010, 90 rural hospitals across the nation have closed, and the rate of them shutting down is only rising. In Missouri and Kansas, six hospitals have closed in the past decade, leaving rural communities with little or no health care. Independence, Kansas is still adjusting after the 2015 closure of its only hospital, and next year the hospital in Fort Scott, Kansas will also close its doors. National Rural Health Day was yesterday, so we have to ask, what is the future of health services in non-urban areas? We're joined now by Lindsay Hansen-Metcalf. She's an author at the Kansas Leadership Center Journal, who spent some time in Independence covering how they survived their hospital closure. She joins us via Skype from her home in Concordia, Kansas. Lindsay, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Dr. Michael Munger is a practicing physician here in Kansas City. He's chairman of the board of directors at the American Academy of Family Physicians. Michael, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Pleased to be here. Thank you.
Michael, tell us a little bit about what the American Academy of Family Physicians has seen with hospital closures in Kansas, Missouri, across the country. What's going on out there?
Well, we really recognize that this is becoming an issue that is critically affecting patients in rural America. I mean, 16% of the population lives there, but we also recognize that for those 16% that are there, they are more medically underserved. We realize that their access to meaningful coverage is down. You know, look, in rural America, 16.9% are actually living at the federal poverty level as a compared to, you know, metropolitan areas. And so we realize this is all coming together to create quite the access issues.
Lindsay, how was Independence affected by its hospital closing? What did you see out there?
I saw a community that had really come together to make it work. They had a lot of chaos in the beginning. When you lose your emergency room, you have to figure out first, where do we go if there's an emergency? They had an ER ambulance transport through the city, so they didn't lose ambulance transport. And the ER staff was used to transporting people across the state because when you're in a rural area, if you have big trauma or something else that the local hospital can't treat, you have to go out of town anyway. But effectively, they had to add two ambulances right away because they needed mobile emergency rooms, basically, to stabilize their patients getting here and there.
Was that the answer for the emergency room question? They had what you just used the phrase, mobile emergency rooms?
That was not the long-term answer. That was the immediate future after 2015. So it took a while for them to figure out, how are we going to get an emergency room? This was a town of about 8,700 people, and they did not want to give that up. A local hospital, neighboring hospital out of Labette County, about, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 miles away.
Right.
They came in and came up with an alternative and opened up a healthcare center with an emergency room, with a helipad, and with a couple of observation beds, but it's not considered a hospital. So it does not have overnight beds.
It's more like a healthcare clinic. Do I have that right?
It has a rural health clinic component, but it does have an emergency room where the ambulance will take you to stabilize you. You have to remember, about a quarter of ER visits are not technically considered emergencies. They don't require overnight stays. So many of the patients that end up there can go home.
Huh. Michael, what has the American Academy of Family Physicians been researching as far as rural health care? What are you guys looking at?
Well, we realize that and recognize this is a multi-layered issue and problem. You know, first and foremost, it starts before a student enters medical school. We recognize that if you select a student who was grew up and from a rural area, they are much more likely to go into a primary care specialty and return to rural America. Hmm. And so it starts from there.
And what else are you looking at?
Well, we also recognize that where you train makes a difference. Starting in 2010, through HRSA, there was funding for the Teaching Health Center Graduate Medical Education Program.
What does that mean?
So what that means is that these are in teaching and residency programs, training programs that are in rural and underserved areas. It's funded not through the traditional GME funding, but through HRSA. And it's actually located in 60 areas around the country where these medical student graduates are training for 3 years in primary care specialties in the communities that are rural and underserved. They're training right where we want them to go into practice. The results of that have been very, very promising so far. We're actually seeing that 3 out of 4 of the graduates will go into practice within 50 miles of where they train.
That's interesting.
So training in rural and underserved areas, they're staying there, serving the community.
Well, so to what extent is this new approach solving the problem?
Well, right now it's small. You know, you're only talking 60 programs. You know, there's been only 700 graduates total over the time. But again, we recognize that moving forward, we think this is a real answer and something that should be expanded.
Hmm. Well, what do you hear from physicians, Michael, working in places like Independence, Kansas? I mean, how are they dealing with these closures?
It is extremely difficult because when you lose that community hospital, you know, you lose the base, and you lose access many times to specialty care that you may need to continue on in your practice. You also recognize that your patient base can actually start to shrink, meaning patients, once a hospital closes, they're now going to start to go to larger areas, other areas to receive their health care. So you're catching it on both ends when you're out in these areas.
So, Lindsay, I'm just guessing here that the closing of this hospital in Independence just must have been like a bomb going off at the middle of Central Street in Maine in that town. I mean, what a blow, right?
Yeah, that's what residents there tell me. They did maintain an urgent care clinic in the immediate aftermath, but it took them a couple of years to get this emergency room reestablished. And in the meantime, as Michael was saying, residents sought care in other places. But what was interesting was that all the neighboring towns with little hospitals, there are six there within an hour's drive, they saw an opportunity for extra revenue with their own hospital. So several of them built clinics there in Independence in the meantime.
Hmm. So it's kind of a piecemeal approach to replacing this hospital, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Absolutely. And another thing that I ran into was if you're transporting patients out of town in an emergency situation and you add the rural component where you have a higher elderly population, you have more people living in poverty, some of those patients aren't able to get home. So there was a component where volunteers had to step up and start driving to get people to and from not only emergency situations, but to take them to specialist appointments. You know, some people had to go to Bartlesville, 45 minutes away, or Tulsa, an hour away. So people, like I said earlier, they made it work, but it's definitely, like you said, a piecemeal approach.
I was going to say, that's a problem, this transportation issue that I never would have thought about before. How did they navigate that? How did people come together to form this little mini transportation network?
It started through the religious organizations. People in the churches were calling their pastors and saying, I can't get home. You know, it's one woman I talked to, she's now a former pastor, but she said she had a constituent or a person in her congregation call at 2 in the morning and said, I'm stuck. They're saying that waiting, that patient visiting hours are over and I can't stay. And so this woman had to get on the phone and say, please let her stay there until I can at least come pick her up. So she had to drive in an ice storm in February to go get this woman.
Wow. Michael, I can't help but wonder about another aspect of healthcare, the whole idea of mental health and practitioners there. What are we seeing on that front when it comes to the kind of care that's available out in the rural parts of our listening areas here?
Well, you know, unfortunately, behavioral health services are in short supply everywhere.
Everywhere.
But it is a critical, critical issue, especially in rural America. You know, this is where needing to look for innovative approaches, looking at telemedicine, which is not necessarily the answer for everything, but certainly is a way that you can help deliver care in that regards.
We're talking about talking to a psychologist, for instance, in Kansas City, if you're living down in Independence.
Correct.
And doing it via telephone, some kind of telephone hookup.
That's correct.
You would think that mental health would lend itself in some ways more neatly in that regard than it would for physical health problems, other kinds of health problems.
Absolutely. You know, this is more of a, you know, it's a cognitive, it's relationship, it's conversation.
Okay. How is your organization, again, the American Academy of Family Physicians, persuading doctors to work in non-urban areas? What else are you saying about that?
Well, we also recognize that on some of the other layers, one, a lot has to do with what can we do as a student comes out of medical school with crushing medical school debt. What can we do around loan forgiveness and loan repayment? And, you know, one excellent avenue that we continue to advocate for strongly is the National Health Service Corps, really where through a federal program you can go and serve in a rural or underserved area to have your loan repaid and forgiven. And we also recognize if we...
Where does the money come from to do that?
Those are usually from HRSA funds, and they're funded each year.
And HRSA, again, remind us, is what?
Is the Health Resources and Service Administration.
So it's a federal government program.
Federal government program.
Gotcha. Yeah.
You know, and this is also something that we continue to advocate for. Earlier this year, funding was in jeopardy for the National Health Service Corps, also for the Teaching Health Center graduate medical education that I talked for. Our organization recognizes these are cornerstone to really getting physicians to rural areas, and so we continue to advocate strongly on the Hill to make sure that funding is preserved.
And you can only begin to imagine, Michael, this problem's only going to get worse as time passes, as rural counties continue to depopulate.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's why we really, I think, need to continue to strongly move. And I think the other component that we haven't talked about yet is expansion of Medicaid and to really make sure now that we can get more individuals eligible for coverage. And then on the physician side, get ourselves back to Medicaid to Medicare parity, bring Medicaid levels up to that of Medicare, because in a rural area, you know, as a practicing family physician, you have, you know, basically Medicare, Medicaid, and self-pay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your payer mix. And so you really need to be able to make sure the physicians can meet their margin. But more importantly, you got to make sure that the patients can have the coverage so they can access care, not delay care, get what they need.
You're saying you don't see private health insurance out in rural areas as often?
You don't see it as often. It is there, but it's not as often as you would say in a metropolitan area.
And why is that? Just because those companies won't service rural communities?
That's exactly right. You actually see that a lot of the employer-based insurance, because there is not as much business and not as many employers in a rural area, you don't have as much access to that.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about this challenge of rural healthcare. We're visiting with Lindsay Hansen-Metcalf, who's written an article about the situation in Independence, Kansas, for the Kansas Leadership Center Journal. I'm also joined by Dr. Michael Munger, who's a practicing physician here in town. He's chairman of the board of directors at the American Academy of Family Physicians. You know, Lindsay, the whole, the notion of Medicaid expansion just came up. It's been in the news lately with the election of Governor Laura Kelly in Kansas, who's an advocate for expanding Medicaid. That's been turned down by Republican governors in recent years. What do you hear about Medicaid expansion in a town like Independence, Kansas? Is that an issue that people chat about, that they desire, or is it not a big deal?
It absolutely is an issue that they desire. One example would be the state representative from Independence, Representative Jim Kelly. He's a Republican, and he championed the bill to expand Medicaid that failed in Kansas. The only reason it failed was because it passed both chambers, but Governor Brownback vetoed it. And then when the attempt to override came, they fell three votes short.
Yeah, just a few votes short, yeah.
Yeah. Representative Kelly is hopeful that this issue will come up again in the new session. And, you know, you see several Republican legislators who have supported the bill, including in my district, Representative Susan Concan, and she just won her election and had been in loud favor of Medicaid expansion.
And the dynamics have changed so dramatically here because Laura Kelly is saying she will sign it. The need for a two-thirds majority to override a veto is no longer needed. You can pass expansion with a simple majority, and a lot of folks think those votes are at hand now.
Right, and you'll see in other conservative states with this last election, there were three heavily Republican states that passed referenda to include Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. You had Idaho with 62% approval and Nebraska with 53% approval and Utah as well. So,
if you're talking about Idaho and Utah, you're talking about staunchly Republican red states. So you'll begin to think that maybe the time for expansion might be coming sooner rather than later in Kansas. You know, going back to the clinic model that Independence is trying, does that appear to be the model that's going to work across rural Kansas, Lindsay, and maybe even the entire country? Is that what we're probably going to be seeing here going forward?
That's what advocates tell me. I had spoken with the Kansas Hospital Association, Jennifer Findlay. She's been working on a separate issue like this for several years. They call it the primary healthcare model. It doesn't exist yet. They're going to be trying to get approval from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. But it looks a lot like what's happening in Independence. They are talking about an emergency room, basic, you know, observation beds, rural clinic, and they really have to think about how do we finance this. Mm-hmm. The revenue comes from inpatient beds traditionally in a traditional hospital model. So they're looking at shifting toward grants, donations, value incentives, that kind of thing to fund this. But there have been neighboring states that have been interested in what they're doing as well.
You know, Lindsay, Michael Munger here in the studio was talking about this idea, this concept of telemedicine a few minutes ago. What are you seeing in Independence when it comes to use of long-distance televised telemedicine techniques?
I didn't do a lot of reporting in that arena, but Representative Kelly did mention it because he sees the potential for it to, you know, increase going forward. Former Governor Collier signed a telemedicine bill in the spring, and that will increase access to this very service, because a lot of the time when you go see a specialist, I mean, think about it, you have to do an in-office consultation before you really get started with your treatment.
Right.
So at least those initial consultations could happen via Skype or something similar.
Michael, what are the downsides to telemedicine? What gives doctors, what causes them to hesitate when it comes to something like that?
Well, I think one of the keys you have to make sure is that if you're going to utilize telemedicine services, it has to be within the construct of a continuous ongoing relationship. You need to be the one that is there. Either your patient is consulting a specialist that is in a metropolitan area, but they're still your patient. You're there to help coordinate their care. You want to make sure that you're not going to fragment care through use of telemedicine or telemedicine services where you're not keeping everything coordinated. Mm.
And again, going back to the notion of Medicaid expansion, you know, when it comes to a community like Independence or other communities, Fort Scott, that might be is in danger of losing its hospital here, would expanding Medicaid save hospitals in towns like Independence and Fort Scott?
Well, I don't know if it would by itself save, because it obviously is a multi-layered or multifactorial problem. But mm-hmm. we have seen, as all the hospitals you've mentioned that have closed, you know, 6 out of 10 were in states that did not expand Medicaid. And mm-hmm. so, you know, we recognize that absolutely that component of it is definitely a factor.
You know, you've spent some time out in Washington, D.C. I'm wondering, what federal legislation is in the works to help rural communities get access to the types of programs we've been talking about here?
Well, you know, right now I'm not aware of a lot on the federal level that's mm-hmm. really cooking right now. I know that there have been some things just recently around, say, the Medicare physician fee schedule that just was finalized and came out that just talking about telemedicine is actually going to provide rural health clinics some ability to have some additional revenue around coordination of care and that sort of thing around using telemedicine services.
Yeah. You know, one thing I haven't asked you, Lindsay, when Independence went to this clinic model of health care down there, you know, did local people have to raise money to get that done?
Yeah, that was a big component. There was a little bit of funding from the city, I think $200,000 they kicked in, and the county kicked in another $100,000, but it was mainly local investment from Labette Health Corporation and also from local donations. I mean, people were sending money in $50,000 at a time, and that's a lot of money in a rural area where jobs don't pay as much.
How much money did they have to raise to get this done?
I don't have my notes in front of me, but I want to say it was around $7 million to build the new healthcare center.
You know, in a small town, Lindsay, that's just that's a whole lot of money.
It is so much money. I live in Concordia, Kansas, as you mentioned,
right.
And we are facing the same issues. We still have a hospital. We are losing services like maternity care. But several years ago, local referendum failed when hospital officials asked for a bond issue to help with the new hospital. So local officials here are still trying to figure out how can we rebuild when we've got an emergency room on the fourth floor in this outdated building. Luckily, they have partnered with a larger facility, Salina Regional Medical Center, to
right.
the south, but many of the same issues are being faced all over Kansas.
You know, Michael, I can't help but reflect a little bit as we're talking here about conversations we've had in this studio about the public defender system in Missouri, a different kind of care in a sense. But when that system gets overloaded, private attorneys are often called in to help handle cases for folks who can't afford attorneys. I'm wondering, on the medical side of the ledger in that world, what about the obligations of doctors in private practice, say here in Kansas City, to go out one day a week or 2 days a month to help folks in rural parts of America who need their help?
Well, you know, certainly it's something that is very, you know, would provide a lot of value. I think the key is the fact that, you know, we are facing a primary care shortage everywhere. You know, and quite honestly, to break away from a busy practice in the metropolitan area,
you're leaving folks here wanting.
And the other thing is, you know, just doing periodic outreach in terms of primary care, where, you know, there's a need for that continuous ongoing relationship where you need somebody that's accessible 24/7. You know, that also creates challenges just to drop in you know, once or twice a month or once a week. And so certainly outreach clinics are going to be part of the solution, but I think not the only solution.
You know, I certainly understand the need for rigorous standards before anybody becomes an MD, but has the profession, has the higher education world made becoming a doctor too difficult, too arduous, and that's just resulted in fewer people going into that line of work?
I don't think it's a matter of that. We're actually seeing more medical schools open up and more graduates of medical school now than ever before.
Really?
Yeah. And I really don't believe that it is too arduous. I mean, we don't want to slip to a lower bar. We should demand excellence, and that excellence should be of training.
I understand that completely.
But I think the real issue is, what's the composition of our workforce? You know, and we really are woefully inadequate when it comes to primary care. You know, right now, if you look at our overall workforce across the country, not just in rural America, if you count in family medicine, general internal medicine, general pediatrics, that only represents about 31% of the physicians. Most other countries around the world have 50% of their workforce in generalist or primary care specialties. And so we really need to now look at, how do we make the shift? How do we encourage these students to match into the primary care specialties to build up the workforce for everyone?
Well, how do you do that if those folks don't make as much money, which is the central issue here, right?
Right. I mean, I think there's a lot of creative ways. Number one, you need to make sure that we have good payment reform, and that's being talked about a lot. You need to have more of the spend overall in medicine. You can keep the pie the same, but instead of only spending, you know, 6 to 7 cents on the healthcare dollar
right.
in primary care, double that. If you double that, you're going to see a lot of changes. You'll see the ability to deliver comprehensive primary care. And then I think, as I mentioned earlier, you also couple, if you can have some loan forgiveness and loan repayment options, especially for students choosing primary care, really creates quite a workforce.
Well, why isn't this happening sooner rather than later? We've been talking about these needs for several years. Why hasn't the switch, the reimbursement rate for general practitioners, why hasn't that increased?
You know, I think there's a lot of factors that are playing into it.
Politics, right?
Politics.
Yeah.
But I think we are hopefully seeing some movement. I mean, we are seeing changes, and I think things should be coming soon, hopefully.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Dr. Michael Munger. Again, he's the chairman of the board of directors at the American Academy of Family Physicians. He's also a practicing doctor here in town. We were also joined by Lindsay Hansen-Metcalf. She's an author of an article in the Kansas Leadership Center Journal about the closing of the hospital in Independence and how Independence managed that. Lindsay, it's so good to hear your voice again. Thanks for taking some time.
Yeah, good to talk with you, Steve. Thanks.
Michael, good to have you too.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about an opera focused on the idea of driving while black. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. Yesterday, we talked with the new leader of Jackson County's anti-drug task force. We discussed the relationship between drug use, violence, and mental health in Kansas City. You can hear that and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday, a major climate report describes a strong risk of crisis as early as 2040. How will climate change affect Kansas's prairies, and is it ready? We'll ask a climatologist and a Kansas prairie scientist. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Susan Kander was eager to write some new music, but the right topic kept eluding her. Then it hit her, driving while black. Kander's musical partner was Roberta Gumbel, a lecturer in voice and opera at KU. Her son had just reached driving age, and Gumbel, like many African-American parents in the wake of recent police shootings, was worried that her son could be profiled by police and for arrest, or even worse. That's how the new chamber opera project titled DWB, shorthand for Driving While Black, was born. It's to be performed this week and in Lawrence. Let's hear a little sampling of it now, a moment many parents will be able to relate to.
Move the seat. Adjust the mirror. Seatbelt.
With us to talk about it now are Roberta Gumbel, a lecturer in voice and opera at the KU School of Music and the sole singer in Driving While Black. Roberta, welcome.
Thank you.
Susan Kander is the composer. Susan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And I just got to laugh. When I was teaching my son how to drive, we were learning on a stick. We were sitting in a parking lot of a large church late at night on a cold winter night, and the car is kicking and starting as he's trying to engage the clutch, and it's killing and rolling all over the place. Next thing we know, there's no car within, 600 yards of where we're sitting. There's lights in our rearview mirror. An officer had seen the car kicking and starting and pulled up and wondered what was going on. Scared my son half to death. I think every parent has got a story like that, Roberta. Mm-hmm. So Susan, where did this idea of doing a production centered on the idea of Driving While Black, where did that come from?
First of all, it came from my desire to write for Roberta any chance I get. Huh. We have done a lot of work together. I've written a lot of music.
Why do you like working with her so much?
Because she's just the best soprano ever. She has a creamy, beautiful, gorgeous voice.
It sounded like it in that tape, yeah.
Amazing way of inhabiting words and character, and we've known each other a long time. And a composer who has a specific voice and a specific persona in their ear and in their mind that they can write for is a very lucky composer.
Yeah.
So I sort of leaped on her. I think she probably would agree to that.
She twists my arm regularly.
I do, as often as possible.
So which one of you had the idea of doing DWB, Driving While Black? Was it you, Susan? Yeah.
Actually, it came out of, the first step was that I wanted to write for Roberta. And I knew that she had just gone on the faculty at KU. Mm-hmm. And I also had two other friends on the faculty at KU, which are Hannah Collins and Michael Compitello, who mm-hmm. together are New Morse Code.
New Morse Code, the group.
The
yeah.
group. Mm-hmm. And they're a percussion cello duo, which is pretty unusual. And it was kind of a no-brainer. I thought, here are these people I know, and they're all incredible musicians, and I've got to figure out a way to write for them. So I approached Roberta, and we talked about a whole lot of different topics, things that...
How did DWB come up?
Well, I have two sons, but they were born and raised in New York City. So not only are they white, so I don't have any of those concerns, but in New York City, children don't drive.
They were older, weren't they?
They're a little bit older than Rayfield.
When they began to drive, yeah.
Yeah, but they're much older. And in fact, we didn't have a car, so there was no purpose in teaching them how to drive. So I was completely saved from the whole parental angst mm-hmm. of having teenagers drive. But my friend Roberta was going through it all the way. And I kept coming back to her. And I mean, this was before we were even talking about doing a piece together. It was like, your son is about to drive and you have to teach him to drive, and what a world. And that's how we kind of arrived.
Well, Roberta, tell us about that. What were your concerns as your son began to learn how to drive? What was going through your mind?
Well, all you have to do is read the newspaper or watch the news
almost
daily.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversations Susan and I were having were pretty much just dinner conversation, talking about, because we're good friends, so we
yeah.
talk about our children.
Right.
And these concerns, and she's watched him grow up, and I said, now he's driving, and I'm wondering how afraid I need to be for his well-being. He went to Pembroke Hill School. It's not high on his radar to be thinking of himself as someone that might be profiled or anything else. And I said, you need to understand that it doesn't matter where you live, where you went to school, or anything else. The first thing someone is going to see is your color. And so we've had these conversations off and on. And then Susan called me one day and she said, I know what I want to write about.
Hmm.
And I want to do it about these conversations we've had.
How did you feel about that?
I said, that's great. I think that would be timely and certainly not done otherwise. I said, the problem is that you can't write the text because you're white and no one would really accept it from you.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, I know that because she's smart. And she looked for a playwright or a poet and wasn't able to find the one that she really wanted, whose name escapes me, was unavailable.
Mm.
So then she called me one day and she said, you have to write it.
Mm.
And I said, I don't write. She said, well, you have to write it. And so I did, and that's the way it evolved.
How did you approach it? I mean, how did that roll out from you?
Initially, I just started writing sort of vignettes or things that have happened, and Susan would say, yes, work with that, bring that in. And it ended up being autobiographical, although there are things in it that aren't, you know, exactly me. And I pulled on stories that I know that have things that have happened to my nephews, who are older and so have more history behind the wheel or in any environment than my son had so far. And Susan just kept pulling it out of me. She's a writer as well, so she was guiding me. And then it just evolved, and then she shaped it musically.
Well, what were you looking for from Roberta? When you say you wanted her to write this thing, what did you want her to do? How did someone who's not a writer of operas, what did you expect?
Well, it's interesting you say she's not a writer of operas. That wasn't what we were looking for. That's not what we needed, because this is, we call this piece an opera because we haven't come up with a better word for it, but it's really music theater.
Okay.
It's a story, it's a theatrical experience that happens to be being told through music.
Not to be confused with musical theater. We're not saying this is Broadway style
right.
or anything like
Clearly
that.
Clearly not. Yeah, right.
Correct. And I was completely confident that Roberta knew the ingredients for that kind of a thing, that kind of a theatrical animal. And we sat together, actually, in my house in New York, and we talked about what shape it might have. We originally started talking about a song cycle. And that gave it an episodic quality. Then, the more we talked about it, Roberta came up with a way to create an overarching narrative, a way to get from the beginning to the middle to the end.
And the overarching narrative is what?
The birth and the growing up of the child, and how that would be created on stage in the absence of an actor. There is no child on the stage. So Roberta came up with the idea of how we would indicate to the audience how big is the child, where's the child, it's growing up. And that's the idea was brilliant. It's about where the child is in the car. The only thing on the stage is four chairs. And so where that child is in the car, which is to say where the mother relates to it in the car.
Right.
As soon as Roberta actually had that idea, the whole rest of the thing fell into place, because then we knew we could interrupt that narrative and put in these scenes that we call bulletins, which are not part of the narrative, not part of the personal narrative. They're part of the zeitgeist.
Meaning what's going on out in the country, out across
right.
the world
and
about
what,
this.
And what the mother is hearing and seeing and knowing going on as her child grows up. And it's building up in her mind and in her experience as the child gets closer and closer to driving.
If you just join us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about a new production that'll be shown this weekend over in Lawrence, Driving While Black. It's called DWB. It premieres at 7:30 in the evening tomorrow night, the 17th, at the Lawrence Arts Center. That's right down on right downtown there, 940 New Hampshire Street. For tickets, go to lawrenceartscenter.org. I'm just wondering, Roberta, what was the toughest part of all this for you, that wrapping your arms around and trying to convey?
Well, it's sort of the hardest part was also the easiest part, because if it's my story, then I didn't have to use my imagination and come up with something novel or new. The harder part of that is exposing my story. You know, at one point, my husband died 10 years ago of cancer. So at one point, we noted that now I'm a single mother. But I was, Susan and I discussed it. I said, we have to put in there that he died of cancer. In the world today now, it's going to look like he was shot or he was in some way a part of these bulletins. And the whole point is that we're just living everyday lives. And everything that happens to an African American is not necessarily ripped from the headlines. We're just carrying on about our business. So I had to expose things about myself that I really didn't particularly need or feel driven to explain, other than I didn't want it misunderstood. So I had to expose a little bit of that. My son is coming tomorrow night, and he's not heard the piece.
Oh, really?
He has no idea, I think, quite how personal it is. And I'm wondering, when he listens to it, will he remember the things that I've actually described?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it a blur for him because he was so much younger?
You know, this is interesting to me, this notion that he wasn't even aware that he could be profiled because of the color of his skin. As his mother, you had to sort of sit him down and tell him, listen, Buster, you might be in for something here.
It is a conversation that I think is having to happen in most black households now. Someone was telling me the other day about some television show where they said, have you had the talk yet? And I said, oh, are we talking about the birds and the bees? And says, no, the talk about your role and your being profiled or the possibilities of your place in society now. It's changed. And so these are conversations we have to have. And it maybe from my father's time, you didn't have to have the conversation because it was institutionalized, you know, Jim Crow, whatever. But now we're allowed to forget sometimes, and then boom, it comes right back and it's in your face. And so, yeah, he hadn't thought about it. And at 14, you don't want to scare your child.
Mm-hmm.
But then at 15, when they get their permit, you have to start reminding them that they watch their P's and Q's. I have to tell him when he walks the dog, make sure he stays on the sidewalk so somebody doesn't put on the Next Door app that there's a black kid in the neighborhood, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to make a big deal of it, but I don't want to be the parent that didn't look at reality in the face and tell my kid about it. So,
Susan, these are conversations that you and I never had to have with our kids.
Exactly. And being friends with Roberta while Rayfield was growing up and while her husband was dying and she was learning how to single parent and all of those things, I think she's amazing. And because I won't have those experiences, but because they stir up emotion in me, I think that's why I was drawn to do this story. It is a story that I could never do alone.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm grateful and happy that we can tell it together.
Well, let's listen to another excerpt from this production. Again, this is Roberta Gumbel singing with the new Morse code in DWB. That's just extraordinary. And Roberta, I got to ask, you know, we've had Joyce DiDonato in here any number of times. And for the love of Pete, I don't know how anyone can do that with their voice. That's just so extraordinary to me. You know,
well,
how does that
she's
happen?
Amazing.
Well, you're amazing. How does that happen? You know?
You know, they talk about having gifts, and I can't claim responsibility for it. I was blessed with it. My mother sang, evidently my grandfather sang, although not professionally. I have lots of musical people in my family, and I got lucky.
Yeah. Well,
sometimes I don't feel lucky. Sometimes it's a curse because it's what I do best, but not always what I feel like doing.
Mm-hmm.
But
why don't you feel like doing it sometimes?
It's hard.
Yeah,
it's hard. And sometimes temperamentally, you're not necessarily suited for it. But I keep
doing it. You got to be in the right space.
Yeah, yeah. But Susan makes me sing even when I don't want to.
Well, you having heard that, you can see why I would want to write for Roberta.
It's becoming very clear here, Susan.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the other performers here because they're KU School of Music teachers too, mm-hmm. Susan. Who are they?
Hannah Collins is the cello professor mm-hmm. there, and she is just extraordinary. I know her through my son, who was a colleague of hers at Yale, and together they, with a bunch of other people, they created an ensemble for doing chamber music and much of it vocal chamber music, which isn't so often done. And Hannah's just, she's just a virtuoso on the instrument, but she's also just an extraordinary musician, an expressive, phenomenal, top drawer musician.
And who's your percussionist?
Mike Compitello is her partner. He's also a product of Yale, and he's one of those percussionists who can play 17 things at one time. Mm. And in fact, when I started writing this, I wrote him an email and I said, "Don't worry, I know that I'm writing for you as if you had three arms and three legs, but we'll get there. We'll pare it down after I put everything I want on the page. Then we'll together we'll pare it down and it'll be everything you can do."
Did he accuse you of trying to kill him when he saw the score originally?
Or? No, he was very calm. He was very calm. And
he took it like
there
an adult.
There was one email in which he reminded me that he did need one foot to stand up on most of the time. And so I couldn't use 2 feet all the time. but they're amazing musicians and they're amazing people. And not every musician is suited to drama, suited to a theatrical endeavor like this. And this is a very emotional piece of work. And Mike and Hannah are those kinds of musicians. There's a lot of musicians that aren't, but they definitely are.
They go by the name New Morse Code. Why? Do you know what the...
I don't know. I think it probably has to do with percussion and dots and dashes, but it's their name and they've done well by it. They're well known.
You know, you chose to use only a cello and percussion in this piece, and I'm wondering why.
Ah. As in most artistic creations or artistic endeavors, the more limitations you have, the greater the creativity is demanded. And I had never heard a sound
That's
world.
Interesting.
We call it a sound world, and the sound world of this piece is soprano, cello, and percussion. Now, percussion is a very, very broad idea. I wish I could tell you the number of instruments that he's actually playing, but it's, you know, 20-something instruments. It's vibraphone-based, so that's the principal pitched instrument, but he is very, very busy. And
I watched a little bit on YouTube last night. He looked real busy.
Yeah, he can be very, very busy. Hannah is one of those musicians who can also do more than one thing at a time. She plays the cello. She plays the foot pedal tambourine. She plays the toy piano.
Wow.
And she, at one point, she plays the toy piano with one hand and she pitches on her cello with another. And, you know, they are remarkable people. And I knew that. So it's very exciting to be able to let your mind go and let your imagination go. And then
knowing you could ride on their backs going forward.
Well, yeah. Count on them to do their best to do what I wrote and then to together talk about how we can make something work if it's not comfortable.
Robert, I just got a little bit of time left, but you're the sole singer here in this production. You carry the piece for the 45 minutes it takes to perform it. Have you done anything like this before? And this sounds like a little bit of pressure.
I've never done a one-woman theatrical production.
Right.
I have sung recitals that last 45 minutes or longer, but usually that's not a through piece where you're having to maintain that energy and the intensity. It's been a challenge.
Yeah.
And it was weird. When we did it in March, we did a reading at KU. I was nervous. And then when it actually started, I wasn't, because there was just, you had to focus so much and really tell the story that I surprisingly was not nervous.
Well, that's good to hear.
The other good thing, and I want to make sure I say this before we're done, Susan writes with the performers in mind, but she also doesn't ask for... She doesn't demand more than you can do. And she's willing to accept questions or fixes if necessary.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. DWB again premieres 7:30 tomorrow evening at the Lawrence Arts Center, downtown Lawrence. For tickets, lawrenceartscenter.org. Roberta Gumbel, good luck tomorrow night.
Thank you.
I'll be rooting for you. Susan Kander, the composer, thanks for coming in and sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
On Monday, a recounting of Ernest Shackleton's cruise attempt to trek across Antarctica to the South Pole. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.